You're listening to a History Hub podcast. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin. Subscribe to our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and on SoundCloud. For more information and to listen to hundreds of podcasts, go to historyhub.ie. The annual Tudor and Stuart Ireland Interdisciplinary Conference welcomes established academics, early stage and independent researchers, as well as postgraduates from Ireland and beyond to present their research in a genuinely collegial environment. Conference takes place in a venue in Ireland in August every year, and for more information on attending, go to tudorstuartireland.com. The 12th annual Tudor and Stuart Ireland Interdisciplinary Conference took place in the University of Galway in August 2024. The conference was organised by Mary-Louise Coulihan, Maureen DeLeo, Andrew Levy, Brenda Louise, Millie Randall and Ian Wong, and generously supported by the Department of English at the University of Galway and Marsh's Library. As in previous years, the majority of papers were recorded for podcasting by Real Smart Media, in association with UCD's History Hub. There is now an extensive archive of around 300 podcasts from previous Tudor and Stuart Ireland conferences freely available to listen to. To access this archive, go to historyhub.ie or search for Tudor and Stuart Ireland on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud or on Spotify. In this episode, a recording of the closing plenary address which is given by Hiram Morgan from University College Cork. His paper was entitled Going Dutch, Ireland and the Low Countries, 1491 to 1691.
First of all, I'd just like to say thank you for the invitation here. It's been a marvellous conference, at least so far it has been. The papers I've heard have been terrific. And if I get anywhere near the plenary given yesterday by Sarah, I'd be well on my way. So this is an overview of Irish connections with the Low Countries. It is done because whilst connections with the likes of France and Spain are given prominence, the important links we have with the Netherlands are often neglected. These links were at their strongest in the early modern period. I've long had an interest in this since I attempted a comparison between the revolt of Hugh O'Neill in the Nine Years' War and the Dutch Revolt, which was published in the Historical Journal about 30 years ago now. The nub of that was that liberation in the Netherlands was bottom-up from the towns and provinces, whereas in Ireland it had to be authorised top-down from the Pope, and that made things more difficult in Ireland. But this is a far more extensive attempt, and it reveals, during this long survey, many individual connections, many different periods of contact, many different types of contact, but what it amounts to overall is a bigger question, a very big question. Were the Dutch interests in Ireland really just an extension of their very extensive contacts, business contacts and dealings in England? And by the same token, were Irish links in the Netherlands simply another political manifestation of the Irish seeking allies against England? So at any rate, we'd be looking at connections in both directions. So first go off to the end of the Middle Ages. At the end of the Middle Ages, the relations that existed between Ireland and the Netherlands, then ruled by the Dukes of Burgundy, was a sort of inchoate connection. One lovely connection is this Vision of Tondal painting by what is described as followers of Hieronymus Bosch or school of Bosch. This is a depiction of the visions of heaven and hell had by an Irish knight who hailed from County Cork. However, this doesn't seem to bespeak any direct connection. The original story was written down in a Schottenkloster at Regensburg in Germany, and it probably came through the Burgundian connection into the court in the Netherlands, a manuscript having been made there now in the Getty, around 1475. A more direct political connection is, of course, the other man on the screen here, Perkin Warbeck, who was brought to Cork by a Breton merchant where he was apprenticed to learn English, and that's why I've chosen the date 1491. There, Perkin Warbeck was recognised or taken up by Desmond interests as, quote, the Richard, Duke of York, one of the princes in the Tower. Afterwards, of course, He was taken back to the Netherlands, where he was supported by Margaret of Burgundy, of course herself an English Yorkist, and then later by Maurice Fitzgerald, Earl of Desmond. But of course the attempted invasion of England failed, and Perkin ended up imprisoned by Henry VII and died shortly afterwards. Interestingly, the following year, in 1497, and from the opposite faction, Thomas Butler, Earl of Ormond, goes as English ambassador to the Netherlands, and presumably to keep an eye on what the Yorkists were up to there. As for trade with the Netherlands at this period, at the end of the Middle Ages, it would be interesting to know how much actual trade there was between Ireland and the Low Countries. More than likely, like the Breton merchants' visit to Cork, it was probably indirect, more likely taking place indirectly via ports in England and in France. So if we move on then to the early 16th century, what we see is a further development in relations, a strengthening of relations, and an emergence of a Habsburg alternative just prior to the Dutch Revolt. Now, traditionally, Irish lords not only looked to Yorkist supporters in Burgundy, but also to the French monarchs. But an accidental visit to Conseil in 1518 by Archduke Ferdinand, brother of Charles V, is significant. Coming from Spain, he and his party, mainly Flemish courtiers, were blown off course and had to land in Conseil. Now, of course, Charles V, going in the other direction, had just become king of Spain, and Ferdinand was now heading northwards to become, eventually, 10 years later, king of the Romans. And this connection between Spain and the Netherlands makes an important new power in Europe, the Habsburgs. And afterwards, significantly, the Earl of Desmond begins to court Charles V, sending agents directly to Spain rather than previously seeking alliances with the French king. And this was at a time when England was yet to embrace the Reformation and yet to break with Rome. But at the same time, significantly, we have the remarkable account of this visit by a man called Laurent Vital. It considered Irish dress and habits strange and different, but not particularly barbarous, or at least not as barbarous as the English considered them to be. They were simply different in his eye. The significant thing was that these Flemish visitors weren't historic enemies of the English, and that surely made a difference to how they perceived the people in Conseil and the Irish generally. And not only did Vital provide a remarkably upbeat account of that visit, the visitors also inquired about St. Patrick's Purgatory, the most famous place in Ireland, which of course ties in with their interest in the Tondal story and that whole thing about heaven and hell. And that visit elicits one of the early accounts and one of the only accounts of a female pilgrim to Lough Derg, which Vital records. Also, post-Reformation, we then see the connection with the Netherlands itself grow as Irish Catholics begin to shun Oxford and Cambridge and appear in greater numbers at the University of Louvain, and with the most notable ones being the future Archbishops Cray and O'Hurley. And I think it's Tyrone Nillis who's listed all the Irishmen who went as scholars, alumni of Louvain. So also, and pictured here is Philip and Mary Tudor. There's a brief respite from this new alignment when, in the reign of Philip and Mary, or Mary and Philip, however you want to put it, of England and Ireland, that ironically, in the unlikely event of children, that under this marriage alliance, the Low Countries was to be hived off into a new Habsburg conglomeration, which included England, Ireland, and the Netherlands. And that would be extraordinarily, that would have been a very odd future indeed. It would have left Scotland out of the picture and presumably attached to France at some point, perhaps. And it's interesting also that this reign saw the formalisation of plantations in the Midlands with Queen's County and King's Counties established. And this enables a very interesting comparison between Ireland and the Netherlands, which was also seeing under Charles V the completion of a large-scale centralisation when, during the Guelders War, the northeastern resistance in the Low Countries was led by the Duke of Guelders and his formidable general, Martin von Rossum, which ultimately led to the uniting, after their defeat, of the provinces onto the Pragmatic Sanction of 1548. And the story of the conquest of that periphery has Van Rossum figuring as a sort of bogeyman, a sort of Dutch Shane O'Neill, a cruel and, in fact, a far more efficient Shane O'Neill-type figure. After this blip in the 1550s, things become much more clearer. Elizabeth on the one hand and Philip of Spain on the other are increasingly aligned against each other. Elizabeth and England allying eventually in 1585 with the Dutch Protestant rebels, and Irish Catholic radicals increasingly seeking the support of the Habsburgs as the major Catholic power of the day. So in this period, in the 1570s, and connected to Lord Deputy Sidney in Ireland, we see the creation of a Dutch images of Ireland. Abraham Ortelius's map, including in his Atlas Orbis Terrarum. This, I think, is from the second edition. It only occurs in the second edition from the 1580s. And it's not a particularly detailed map, especially because the interesting thing is that Ortelius is supposed to have come to Ireland, according to his biographer, but there's not a huge amount of material that you would say establishes him as being in Ireland at some point. But the interesting thing is that he uses a lot of stuff in his account of Ireland, his accompanying account of Ireland, just retails mostly the accounts of Giraldus Cambrensis and the miracles and miraculous places of Ireland, and then uses the first edition of Camden's Britannia to provide further information, more up-to-date information. So it's a largely Anglo-centric view of Ireland that he depicts, but not it doesn't seem to have the animus that, particularly in using Camden, that some of the English accounts would have, but it definitely uses Giraldus Cambrensis. Similar ideas of the Irish are contained in the depiction of Irish costume by Lucas de Herr. Lucas de Herr certainly didn't come to Ireland, but he drew Irish figures when he was in England, including wild Irish men, and this one, a wild Irish man and a civil Irish woman. And the interesting thing is, in terms of maps, of course, in the early 17th century, these two aspects of maps, the maps themselves, the outline of the countries, are also become decorative when the figures are added to them. And you have these decorative maps emerging in the 17th century. And Lucas de Herr's images are used then. But the interesting thing also, particularly in relation to Ortelius and his map, is that, of course, it's the map of the maps of the whole world. And the thing is, as regards connection with the Netherlands, is that so much of the knowledge received in Ireland actually comes from the printing presses of Antwerp and later Amsterdam. Irish scholars increasingly purchasing books, and many of those books from the time of Erasmus on are still in some of our libraries today. Also, from this conquest period, let's not forget John Derrick's image of Ireland. It's said that John Derrick had Dutch connections. Some might even claim that John Derrick was Dutch. He went to the Netherlands with the Earl of Leicester in the 1580s. But certainly John Derrick, in creating his famous image of Ireland, did have the assistance of woodcutters who were Dutch, because many of them worked in John Day's studios, which produced these famous images of the Irish. So more specific links with the conquest of Ireland, and you can list them off. First of all, Lord Deputy Sidney, in the attempts of establishing industry in Ireland, he brings a number of artisans and weavers to Swords, or at least he advertises himself as doing so, whether they came or not, another question. Many of these Dutch artisans were supposed to be refugees, but many of the ordinary immigrants to England, even before the Dutch Revolt, were Flemings, the Flemings being the main immigrant community in England before Elizabeth's reign. And we have a note of a Dutch shoemaker in Dublin hosting the German traveller Ludolf von Munchausen in Dublin in the early 1590s, a man called Peter von Herren from Bruges. Munchausen says that he's the only person who can speak German in Dublin, and that's why he stayed at his house. So here also we have Lord Deputy Russell's portrait. The interesting thing about Lord Deputy Russell and Burr from the 1590s, previously they had been governors of the treaty ports that Elizabeth had made with the Dutch provinces, taken as guarantors of their treaty, of Flushing and Brill. Now, the interesting thing that both of these governors, presumably because of their time in the Dutch wars, proved as governors of Ireland particularly hardliners. And also, the interesting thing, also Russell, when he was governor of Ireland in the 1594 to 1597, he also had faced the issue of a divided command in Ireland with Norris, who'd also fought in the Netherlands. And that was a situation that had pertained in the Netherlands as well. And English policy didn't go right because they had military and political issues between themselves. So more generally, during the 9 Years' War, many English soldiers, especially captains, served in the Low Countries. So the Low Countries became a sort of training ground for English arms. Now, I know Ruth was talking earlier about the many Irishmen that served in the army during the 9 Years' War. But the other thing is that many of the English, especially many of the more experienced English soldiers, had trained in the Netherlands. It was a sort of training ground, especially during Essex's time and Norris's time, they were brought over from there. Also at Kinsale, we have also Hippocrates Doten, who was Mountjoy's doctor. And he was a Dutchman, and he left us a very good letter describing the Battle of Kinsale. At the end of the war, we see a number of proposals to get Dutch settlers to come to the new plantations in Ireland. Richard Hadser, another person that Ruth Canning had studied, an old English Protestant from County Louth, he proposed bringing in Dutch settlers. The only Dutchman, though, I can see involved in the plantations at this period was a man called Veronio Martens, a very Shakespearean name. He was a merchant associate of Henry Pyne in the timber and pipe stave trade. Hugh Cuff then, at the end of the war, wrote to the Dutch Reformed Church asking them to help with settlers and investments. That didn't happen. And then when the Ulster plantation was planned, Power Lane, writing from Cork, gave his opinion that Dutch people would make good settlers. He described them, "The Dutch are industrious and their discipline permits not beggars or idle drones amongst them. They plant religion wherever they come and they're not apt to innovations." On the contrary, he felt that the English as settlers, they spent far too much time in the pub. At this period, in fact, the stronger links were probably with the Irish resistance in the Low Countries. The origins of the Irish regiment in the Low Countries was a Stanley's regiment, which had been brought to fight for the English against Spain and which famously had deserted at Zutphen and Deventer. And one of the soldiers becomes important in the war, and that's a man called Hugh Boy McDavitt, who had been an ensign in Stanley's regiment, and he's described it by English intelligence during the war as the principalist man of war of the Irish nation. And he returned to advise O'Neill and O'Donnell. And when the Spaniards come to Ireland in 1596, it's Hugh Boy McDavitt, whom the Spanish call Hugo David, who is the interpreter between O'Neill, O'Donnell and the Spanish agents. Also, one of the things also in comparison is that the Irish adopt aspects of the military revolution, especially regards guns, military discipline and fortifications. And that is possibly because the conditions in the Irish Wars are not unlike the Petit Guerre conditions which pertained in the Dutch Wars, which were long drawn out and often in boggy territory. Then after the war, of course, the Spanish archdukes provide a very warm reception for the earls in flight in 1607. But of course, political circumstances, particularly that peace had been declared between England and Spain, that they were forced to depart. But the other thing is that as a result of the flight in 1607, we have O'Keenan's account of the Low Countries. And of course, that's a very Catholic view of the Low Countries. And it would have been a place where the, you know, what Ireland, they thought Ireland might have been like, I suppose, had plenty of shrines and miracle working against heretics, etc. Also, in the Low Countries, we have, first under Henry O'Neill in 1605, the foundation of the Irish regiments. And that, of course, later makes a contribution to the defence of Flanders, Spanish Flanders, in 1640, particularly when Owen Roe defends Arras. Then also we have in 1627, the Irish being influenced by their surroundings when they make a proposal for a military return to Ireland, which suggests a kingdom-struck republic in Ireland with O'Neill and O'Donnell as sort of captain generals of the nation, like the Dutch stadtholders. And then eventually the resistance is, of course, Owen Roe himself returns in 1642 with 300 veterans to reform the Confederate Army of Ulster. And also other Low Countries veterans like Thomas Preston and Garrett Barry did the same in their province. And you have Garrett Barry's book here about military discipline and military tactics published in the Netherlands earlier. And of course, also in terms of resistance, Hugh Dove, who also returns with Owen Roe, who's the only man to significantly worst Cromwell at Clonmel. Then also, in terms of Irish culture in Flanders, we have at Ostend, through the patronage of Captain Sorley MacDonald, the great Dunara Finn being produced. But really, the cultural running in the Low Countries with the Irish was done elsewhere. Richard Steenyhurst, a one-time Sydney associate, goes into exile, first to Leiden and then Antwerp, and also afterwards Symmachus, and comes back to Brussels, ending up chaplain to Archduke Albert. And, of course, he writes A History of Ireland and also A Life of St. Patrick, the first such books for a continental audience. More generally, under Elizabeth, the Irish were again seeking a Catholic education in the continent. And significantly, Peter Lombard comes to Louvain and eventually becomes professor of theology. And then eventually Irish colleges are founded. First of all, the Anglo-Irish College at Douai, and then the more Gaelic and vastly more significant St. Anthony's at Louvain. There, under Florence Connery and John Colgan, it becomes a cultural and spiritual powerhouse. And their Irish printing press and, of course, association with the Four Masters are very well known. But more, I suppose, significantly, is that Irish clerics make, in the Netherlands, a significant contribution to theological matters. And that is the development of Jansenism, at Louvain. And of course, this is something that Tom O'Connor has developed very significantly. And it becomes a matter of politics back in Ireland when, of course, it comes to negotiating out of the quagmire of the Confederate Wars in Ireland. Although I doubt if Florence Connery would have taken up the position that Tom O'Connor's people are taking up during the in relation to the Ormond Peace. So the connection with the Netherlands in the Irish context is very important in this period, not only in the Netherlands, but if obviously during the period like the Netherlands, it's hoped from the Irish point of view that Ireland will become the England's Netherlands in terms of the military chaos that will be visited upon the English there. Now, to come to Ireland itself and the Dutch coming to Ireland, there's also Dutch influences on Irish Protestantism, and that's, we have to consider Arminianism, and then the debates at the Synod of Dordrecht influencing Irish Protestantism. Regarding the plantations, in fact, in the 17th century, there was actually very few Dutch settlers on the land. De Renzi, who'd been in Antwerp, coming to County Offaly, and the Vandeleurs in Clare. Also, some Dutch women, like William Penn, who spent a lot of time in Ireland. His mother was Dutch, Margaret Jaspers. But most of the people that appear here are men. But doubtless women would appear in with other widows along in wills and whatnot. But most importantly, in the 17th century, Dublin governments in the Jacobean, Caroline, Cromwellian and Restoration periods offered Dutch and other continental Protestant denizen status to encourage trade and manufacturing in Ireland. And there are several examples of this in the patent rolls. For instance, from 1608, grant to William Boyle of Antwerp in Brabant that he be free of the yoke of slavery of Brabant, Ireland, or any other nation, and enjoy the rights of an English subject. Or, quote, license to John de la Grange, otherwise Verhoeven, and Gabriel de Hayes, Dutch merchants, to make oil and soap. And Rolf Loeber, one of the few people to study the Dutch in the 17th century and to assemble sources about them, he notes 25 Dutch merchants and goldsmiths living in Dublin in 1639 and gives the names of Dutch men who supplied the murres of Derry, Dublin and Limerick at various points in the 17th century. And then some of them become victims of the 1641 rebellion. At Skerries in North County Dublin, one of those naturalised Dutch merchants, Derek Huberts of Dort, is murdered at Skerries in 1641. There are Dutch miners killed at silver mines and technicians killed at silver mines in Tipperary. And the interesting thing is that a lot of the English material relating to the 1641 rebellion is published in translation in Amsterdam, and almost all the 1641 material relating to Ireland is published in translation, it seems to me. And that would make an interesting study to see if there's anything that has survived in Dutch sources that have disappeared in the English sources, or if there's anything unique in the Dublin or the Dutch sources published in Amsterdam. But most significantly, after that, in the aftermath of the rebellion, the Dutch were targeted as potential investors by the Act of Adventurers. The most prominent became the Boat brothers, Arnold and Gerard Boat. The former collected information and the latter wrote Ireland's Natural History, 1652, to forward the country's development. As a science-based manifesto for an anglicised capitalist Ireland, I would say that it's a far more important text than Spencer's much-debated view of the present state of Ireland. It objects to the many superstitions that Ireland is said of, superstitious places, St. Patrick's Purgatory. For instance, it lauds the destruction of St. Patrick's Purgatory by during the time of Richard Boyle's Lord Justiceship. It objects to many other superstitions in Ireland, It describes the seacoast. It discusses the exploitation of the land with the drainage of bogs, mining. It does describe the Irish as the most barbarous people on earth. But that, I think, is a result of actually the 1641 rebellion, because others beforehand, like De Renzi, had a much more open view of Irish culture. But I think that essentially after what happened in 1641, the Dutch decide that the English view of the Irish is right. They're ungrateful. All of the economic development that the English had done in the early 17th century, Boat says, has been destroyed by the 1641 rebels. They've demolished everything. So I think that Ireland's natural history is a very significant tract, and one that in our ecological times and environmental times needs reconsideration as of its significance. To go on then to the involvement of the Dutch in Irish maritime matters. The inhabitants of Ireland were buying a lot of Dutch consumer goods, as well as building materials like brick and tiles. And the brick and tiles came as ballast in Dutch boats. So a lot of brick and tile came as building material. Then, significantly also, there is complaints against the Dutch. In 1629, there are complaints that a small number of Dutch have, quote, engrossed the whole trade of Ireland. And on the eve of the 1641 rebellion, there are complaints by Ulster merchants that they're being undercut by the purse of Amsterdam. Additionally, the Dutch were increasingly involved in fishing, in the Irish fisheries for herring and pilchard after the eviction of Basques and Breton fishermen from the Irish fishery in the early 17th century. Now, the reasons for this Dutch success are worth considering why the Dutch were having such an economic impact. And there's several reasons for it. First of all, the Dutch boats, the vloot boats or fly boats, these are significantly more efficient boats. They need fewer sailors to man them, and they carry a lot of cargo. Before he fell out with Veronio Martins, Henry Pine had been a big... This was his pitch to get the Dutch more involved in Irish trade. But in fact, the thing was that they undercut everybody else because they can move goods faster. Also, the Dutch have cheap maritime insurance. And significantly, what enables them to undercut people is that having become citizens of Ireland and also freemen of the cities of Ireland, they don't have to pay customs duty often. So they're able to undercut people and undercut local merchants. So these people are bringing stuff in wholesale to the Irish market. And when you consider the stuff that Ray Gillespie wrote about the drop in customs duties before the 1641 revolt and the economic consequences of that, like the Dutch also would have been drawing bullion out of the Irish economy, the very scarce specie that was required for the cash economy. And this was also happening because of the 30 Years' War, the Dutch had been diverted from their regular trade in Central Europe and Germany because of the wars going on from 1618. So it could be, and it's only speculation, that the Dutch involvement, like sort of multinationals, they could have been undermining as much as developing the Irish economy. Because sometimes when they're given a contract to make soap and whatnot in Ireland, they just simply import a lot of soap much cheaper from the Netherlands. That's speculation, but it'd be interesting really to have that studied seriously. So there are also various maritime incidents that require also attention. In 1614, a Dutch fleet led by Moy Lamberts attacks the pirates of Crookhaven. Now, the English pirates had come to West Cork, were causing havoc right across the western approaches to Europe and operating as far as Morocco back and forth. The Dutch made an excellent map of the area. This is the map. And then they forced James in London to give them permission to mount the attack. Ironically, the main victim was an Irish pirate captain, Patrick Mia, whose boat was sunk and his crew attacked, as well as local civilians and local officials, mostly New English officials, who were there negotiating with the pirates. Afterwards, the following year, a celebratory pamphlet is published in Amsterdam about the attack. That event saw the massacre of about 20 or 30 pirates and their associates in Crookhaven. And that precedes the attack on Amboina, on English traders Amboina in 1623. It's really the indication that the Dutch will not brook any rivalry from the English, and also a demonstration of how important the Western approaches are for trade. The irony was that 10 years later, back in Roaring Water Bay in West Cork, was another man, a Dutch pirate called Cleese Compen. And he was there operating under the, essentially under the protection of the Earl of Thomond, who was Lord President of Munster. And he was attacking as far as the English Channel and coming back to Roaring Water Bay to fence his goods. In 1628, we have the shipwreck of a Dutch prize that they'd taken on their famous attack in on the Spanish treasure fleet in Cuba. And coming back, the Santa Ana Maria was attacked by English pirates and captured. And that ship sank in Castlehaven. And there was a famous admiralty case over it. And as a result of that, one of the nice things was I got to handle the ship's bell, which was brought up by archaeologists. That was one of these things that just happens. And of course, then 3 years later, you have the sack of Baltimore, which is led by a Dutch renegade pirate, one who had changed his religion, Jan Jansen of Haarlemmen, and was now called Murrit Reis. And that there was a sort of technology transfer. That's from the Dutch to the Algerian pirates, and that allowed them to come out into the Atlantic, in a sense. And Jan Jansen was a rival of Cleese Compen, and Jan Jansen turned Muslim, whereas Cleese Compen in 26 came and took a pardon from the Dutch authorities and stopped his piratical activities. And then finally, in 1637, there's another admiralty case about an East India man which gets stranded in Killybegs, of all places. And there's a huge... Everybody basically loots and sells off the sugar and spices, and then there's another admiralty case. So to come near the end, of course, the climax of all this Dutch activity in Ireland is the arrival of William III in Ireland. The ultimate Dutch influence on Ireland was political. In spite of the bitter rivalries of the previous 90 years since the foundation, on the one hand, of the East India companies, then the jostling between the Dutch and English in the narrow seas, it was Dutch intervention which saved the British state from itself. The Dutch intervention ensured parliamentary sovereignty, financial stability through the establishment of the Bank of England, Protestant control over Ireland, and ironically, in the subsequent War of Spanish Succession, the independence of Flanders. In Ireland, ironically, it was the end of Dutch influence. You thought there'd be many more Dutch settlers and a lot more Dutch stuff after 1690, but there wasn't. It was Huguenot soldiers who had fought alongside William at the Boyne and later with Ginkell at Ockrim, who settled in Ireland. They, of course, were evicted Protestant refugees from France. And then it was later poorer economic migrants from the Palatine who came also to Ireland in the wake of the Williamite victory. William's victory ensured Ireland had a distinctive place in the developing Atlantic economy as part of the British Empire. And I really, one of the things I like best is this Dutch map of Munster, and the fledgling dairy industry, where you have all these very Dutch-looking milkmaids and butter makers. But that map is done in, 1682 or 1683, remarkably early. But that shows the Dutch were absolutely right. Munster did become the centre of a global dairy industry, as it is now. Quite remarkable. So that is a very predictive map indeed, that one. So just some extra notes. Some of the Irish, of course, did go, first of all, as Dunkirk privateers, and then as merchant settlers in Flanders. And we have this lovely early 18th century painting of the Archdeacon family. And others became involved in the Ost End Company and other international trading companies to the East Indies and so on and so forth. So the Irish did go to Flanders in the same way as they'd gone earlier to France. Some extra points. I had a long discussion with Jean Fenlon here about dress. Apparently there was difference in dress. You could tell if people were dressed as Dutch style or French style, especially women, about their religion and their political opinions in Restoration England and Ireland and afterwards. But this is Mary II, and she looked particularly French to me. There's also duck decoys, which come, Dutch experts come and establish a whole sort of netting to catch ducks in Irish estates called duck decoys. I presume that produced duck a l'orange when they had their dinner. And then we have these houses, which are supposed to be cork houses, which are called Dutch billies. But that doesn't suggest that anybody came to build these in Ireland. They're simply functional merchants' houses because frequently, especially on quays, that they had cranes at the top of them. So it's just a functional aspect. And so, like you hear in Cork, that there was lots of Dutch influence in 18th century Cork. Well, that's quite unlikely. There weren't many Dutch people about. But they do have these houses, particularly along the quays. But there's similar houses elsewhere in Bordeaux or in Amsterdam. And this is simply a functional aspect of these houses. Also, like we have collections in libraries. And, you know, there are particularly good studies to be done of Williamite stuff about Ireland, in particular in various library collections, the recent Bonar Law collection acquired at UCC. And just finally, the legacy that I point out. The legacy is not, in fact, Orangeism, which is a particularly Irish construct. I'd say that the Dutch connection, at the end of the day, is more important to us than that with Spain and maybe even with France, but possibly less so than the connections with Rome, America, Scotland and England. Orangeism may be on the wane also, but strangely, you know, the European Union continues to exist in a sort of Habsburgian project centred on Brussels. And we have there an Irish college or an Irish centre based in the old Irish college at Leuven. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this Tudor and Stuart Ireland Conference podcast. The annual Tudor and Stuart Ireland Interdisciplinary Conference takes place in a venue in Ireland in August every year. For more information on attending, go to tudorstuartireland.com. There is now an extensive archive of around 300 podcasts from previous Tudor and Stuart Ireland conferences freely available to listen to. To access this archive, go to historyhub.ie or search for Tudor and Stuart Ireland on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or on Spotify.